Sai's Glory, His Divine Story, every Thursday on Morning Glory. Catch the vibe with me, Karuna Munshi, on Radio Sai's Thursday Live on Asia Stream at 9:40 a.m.
Om Shri Sai Ram. Loving salutations at the lotus feet of Bhagwan Shri Sathya Sai Baba, the voice, the ears, the heart and soul of Radio Sai. Sai Ram, dear listeners, and welcome to Thursday Live. You're tuned to our Asia Stream coming to you live from Prashanti Nilayam, the spiritual capital of the universe. My name is Karuna, and it's my divine privilege to be hosting this segment called Morning Glory. On the sound console is audio engineer Brother Sunil. Thank you for staying with us on this balmy Thursday, May the 9th, 2013. We are coming to you live from the Radio Sai studios here at Prashanti Nilayam. The time in Prashanti Nilayam right now is 9:41 a.m. What can I say about the weather conditions here in the Divine Valley? They are ideal for getting your annual dose of vitamin D and a really nice tan. Clear skies, soaring temperatures in the late 30s, sometimes touching 40 degrees Celsius. One can see devotees walking around the ashram in wide brim hats and under umbrellas. But the heat is not deterring seekers from coming into the Divine Valley. As long as you're well hydrated, it's all right to sweat it out for humans. But the birds of Puttaparthi are struggling with the heat, and you can really see it. Here is a suggestion, or should I say a humble request, from the Radio Sai team to all our listeners living in places such as Puttaparthi and surroundings and wherever it's very hot. Please, please place a bowl of water out on your balcony or in your front yard for the birds, squirrels and such to have a little dip and a drink. As Swami has always told us, he roams around us in all forms. So let us please honor his presence in our communities and our homes in the form of our winged birds by indulging them with a thirst-quenching drink. A thoughtful gesture like this can go a long way in helping little birds cope with the heat. Meanwhile, we hope you're coping well by drinking plenty of fluids and maintaining healthy electrolyte levels if you're going through a warm summer wherever you are. Coming up on Morning Glory today, continuing the theme of last week's program, today we have two segments, each of which continues to be a departure from the usual menu served on Morning Glory. Prashanti Nilayam was host to a symposium on unity of faiths on July the 2nd, 2012, with addresses in the morning on Hinduism by His Holiness Swami Dayanand Saraswati and on Islam by Professor Akhtarul Wasi, head of the Department of Islamic Studies, Jamia Millia Islamia, New Delhi. Last week on Morning Glory, you heard Professor Akhtarul Wasi make a moving speech at the symposium. Today I'm very happy to bring you another one of those brilliant talks that had the audience spellbound, this one by His Holiness Swami Dayanand Saraswati. But before that, coming up right here, right now, part two of my Fleeting Moments interview. This two-part interview, as I told you last week, was recorded a while ago and it was played just once on one stream. Hence, it's been long overdue on Morning Glory. In case you missed part one, you can catch it at Thursday Live Archives under last week's program, that is May the 2nd, 2013. Morning Glory downloads, just click on the download and you're there. You can also catch it on our website, radiosai.org/sci-students. So, my dear listeners, here is part two of the interview conducted by Ms. Vasanti Sundaram, a veteran journalist from Dubai. Over now to my conversation with Radio Sai's contributing editor, Vasanti Sundaram.
Going back to your life in Canada, Toronto, you were associated with the Sai organization for about 20 years.
That's right.
You were also involved with the community outreach project, Toronto Walk for Values. How was it born and how did your effort and your participation take it forward?
Actually, my participation was very small. I was one of the many people who worked on the communication team and we tried to get it as much of exposure. The only power that made it succeed was God Himself, and that is Swami. And many of our listeners would have heard about the tremendous success of Swami's school in Toronto, which was founded in the year 2000, which was Swami's 75th birthday. It was Swami's gift to the Canadians. And that school from day one was so organic and so successful in transforming those little children. and by extension their parents and their families, that it became a rage. The parents came back to us and said, you know, we want to give back to the school, and there was no tuition fee, nothing. They felt so overwhelmed. Everybody tries to think these days, the way the world is, that if something is too good to be true, there must be some hidden agenda. And within a few months, they realized there was nothing. It was pure, selfless, altruistic love of Bhagwan Sri Sathya Sai Baba that was touching them. And they wanted to do something back. So they thought of many things, and ultimately they said, what we want to do is to tell more Canadians how life gets enriched when we practice more truth, more peace, more love, right conduct, and more non-violence in our lives. Because their children were bringing this message home, and the home environment was changing, the siblings were changing, the parents were bonding better. So they said, we want more Canadians to realize this. So we are going to hold a walkathon, and typically in a walkathon, you're raising, asking people to pledge money for a noble cause. He said, in this walkathon, we'll ask them to pledge a noble value, a noble cause, not no money involved. We're going to raise the level of human consciousness. So they decided that they wanted to hold the first ever walk for values in the history of humanity, where people would walk and they would wear a big label stating the value of their choice that they were going to practice. But it wasn't going to be simple. Everybody had to do a self-audit and realize what was the area of personal weakness. For example, you know, I'm a parent and patience is something I can use an elephant's patience to navigate through my roles at home and work, and I'm sure you'll agree with me as a working mother. If I chose to practice more patience in the coming year, I'd have to wear a big sticky label on my sleeve.
Oh, it wasn't a holistic theme for that edition
no,
of the walk.
No, everybody had.
Each individual had it. Okay.
There was a holistic theme, for example, for I'm walking for me and my community. But then everybody had to pick their own value of choice. And then, talk of wearing your heart on your sleeve, you had to put that label on your sleeve and walk through the community. And we had bands and we had songs and Sai youth singing on top of big floats and children of the school singing. And from day one, it attracted the attention of policymakers and educators and politicians and business leaders. And they said, this is such a unique idea. Nobody has thought of a walkathon that has nothing to do with money and money pledges, but it wants us to become better Canadians, better citizens, better human beings.
Without fearing being judged.
Judged
yeah.
at all. Mm. So it was open to everybody, and the school did not even anticipate that thousands would turn up for the first one. Now, this past May, which is 2012, the 10th anniversary of the Walk for Values was celebrated. And over the years, the Prime Minister of Canada, the Governor General of Canada, the Ontario Premier of the State of Ontario, the Province of Ontario, the Mayor of the City of Toronto, members of Parliament, member of the Federal Parliament, members of the Provincial Parliament, business leaders, educators, everybody wants to be associated and walk. The police force loves us. I'll give you an instance. I think around the time when we were doing the second annual Walk for Values, we always have to get these permits because some roads have to be closed for thousands of people to walk through and the floats to go. So we worked with the Ontario Provincial Police, and the police came to us and said, oh yes, you must take Sai Baba's message of compassion and forgiveness to a particular, they suggested a community we should walk through, because they said that the community had a huge problem with drugs, and a recent police crackdown ended up hauling a lot of youngsters from that community and taking them to jail. So there's a lot of hurt and anger with the parents. They don't see that their children deserve to be in jail even though they were peddling drugs and doing something which was illegal. So he said they can all use the message of love and peace, and they can use forgiveness and compassion. Can you please walk through this downtown area where there's a lot of law and order problem with these positive messages from Sai Baba.
Kind of a healing process.
Very healing process. And we carry big banners and posters that have Bhagwan's divine messages. And the response from total strangers is just incredible. People stop us and say, this is so beautiful. This is how the world should be. Where is Sathya Sai Baba getting this wisdom from? Who is he? Is he a great educator? Answer to everything is yes, yes, and yes, because Bhagwan is the greatest teacher, supreme teacher to humanity and much more. So my association with the Walk for Values has been a very humbling and beautiful experience. I have been involved with taking the media part of it, the communication, creating awareness about it. What started as a small token of appreciation from the parent council of the Sathya Sai School is now become an international phenomena. 12 cities in Canada observe or hold their local Walk for Values.
Does it happen at the same time?
Actually, because of the weather, for example, city, because some places are a little bit cooler than others, but within about 2 weeks span.
Okay.
So, late May to mid-June, all over Canada, 12 cities observe, and in Ottawa, they end it at the steps of the Canadian Parliament, where the actually a member of Parliament, she passed a motion in favor of the Walk for Values because she said it was being held in her riding and all Canadians should practice more truth, more peace, more love, more right conduct and nonviolence. It's been an enormous, I would say, a tool to take Bhagwan's message mainstream to Canadians. And now about a dozen countries around the world are also holding their own Walk for Values, learning from the Canadian experience.
Amazing.
It is.
When I come back to Puttaparthi here, I'm going to take you into the present now and ask you some questions that have been asked to me. I'm going to get answers from you. If you had your way, what is the one thing you would change at Puttaparthi?
At Puttaparthi? Yes. By Puttaparthi, I'm assuming the town of Puttaparthi?
Yeah, you could. Let me take it from there.
Well, I would love for the peace, the pure and the clean environment of our ashram to extend beyond its walls into the streets of this town. And I would love to experience the same honesty, the same efficiency and the cleanliness that exists inside the ashram to prevail in the local businesses outside as well. Typically, you know, we attend these trance-inducing, elevating programs in the Sai Kulwanthal and after the Aarti and the Mahasamadhi Darshan. As we walk out through the gates, Ganesha gates, we're hit like with a ton of bricks with the chaos, the noise, the commercialism that happens right outside our gates. I wish that would become more sane.
Streamlined.
And streamlined.
Mm.
And be more, and would resonate Swami's teachings better.
Mm-hmm.
And if I had my way, I would have the entire town designated as a World Spirit Heritage Site because of its spiritual significance. So that everything that happens in Puttaparthi is in sync with what happens inside the ashram. Because I find inside the ashram we have a haven. And Swami has created this paradise for us. It's lush green, there is no pollution, very little vehicular traffic. Everything is orderly, calm and peaceful. I'd like that to extend beyond the walls.
Mm. Hopefully it'll happen. More into the present, Karuna, with Baba's physical departure from this world, what is the resource that you most reached into in order to remain afloat?
It's funny, it reminds me of a few lines from a poem by Tagore from the Gitanjali where it says that my rebellion strikes against thy love with all its might and still it cry remains, I love thee and only thee. Because after the Mahasamadhi, for about the first 10-12 months, I had these 2,000 gallons of tears and pain locked in my heart. And I was so upset with Swami for leaving us when he did. And I was as fragile emotionally as millions of his devotees around the world. Now my defense mechanism since my childhood is to have constant conversations with Swami in my heart. And these often turn into heated arguments and fights because he is my only confidant and he is my only best buddy in the whole wide world. So when I had to complain about anything in the world, I would turn to Swami. And when I had to complain about Swami, I again turned to him. So through these arguments, I just poured my pain at his lotus feet. And I told him how upset I was with him. And I found the process was very therapeutic and it healed me because I felt Swami was really listening to me and he helped me tremendously. And I'll share just a small experience with the listeners. Sometime after Swami's Mahasamadhi, on a very hot day in maybe June, I was at home in the afternoon working on a file on my computer and I had to come back to office at about 3. So I went to wash my face. It was very hot, but I chose not to wipe it because I wanted a wet face under the blast of the air conditioning vent and the fan whirring over my head so that it would dry and feel cool and sweat-free for a few minutes because I feel very hot. You know, coming as I am from very close to the North Pole, I find Parthi very hot at times. But when I came out of the bathroom, I said, okay, before I leave for work, let me just lie down for a few minutes. I've been working non-stop in front of my computer all day. And I lay down with no intention to sleep, just to stretch my back. But I didn't realize, I instantly dozed off. And all of a sudden I woke up maybe a few minutes later, just maybe 7 to 10 minutes later. I said, oh, I didn't realize I fell asleep. And I stood and I just caught my reflection in the mirror and I found I had this big Vibhuti Tilakam on my forehead. And I know I fell asleep with a wet face, with a washed face, not wiped. And there was this big Vibhuti Tilakam and I knew that Swami had come through for me because I was really hurting and I was aching and I was so upset and I couldn't make sense of all my decisions that I had made with regards to Swami and relocation to Puttaparthi and with Swami's departure. Where did I stand in the scheme of things? What was he thinking? You know, was he even thinking? I was thinking along those lines. And just that one token of his presence and his love, it just pacified me in an instant. I knew there was a method to the madness.
Yes.
And he had his own plans.
Mm. And you people always, I mean, like, I know, at least I'm one of them, who look up to you for gaining inspiration to stay on the path, given the devotion that you exemplify. Did you feel your courage deserting at this time? Was it an enormous strain to put up a brave face in front of those people who were looking for your hand to hold on to?
When Swami was hospitalized, we were all equally concerned and worried. And it coincided with our plans, my family's plans to visit US and Canada that summer. So we didn't know whether we should leave or cancel our program. And as we sought answers, we were clearly guided to go to Canada and US. So somehow we rationalized and thought, you know, Swami's going getting better. Sometimes we used to get a little bit of news from the hospital. Oh, today Swami responded to this or that in the initial stages of his hospitalization. So we became hopeful, and it was wishful thinking on the part of millions of Swami's devotees. We said maybe the recovery period will be long, but Swami will be fine. So we proceeded to Toronto. As soon as we reached, the news started to turn a little dismal, but all the centers wanted me to come and speak to them. And, you know, Toronto has a sizable Sai population. So I found myself speaking in the morning, afternoon, every weekend, every Thursday evening at different centers. And as per my own understanding and thinking, I told everybody that, you know, this is the time for all of us to unite and pray, and Swami will respond to our prayers and he will be okay. So I was trying to infuse courage and faith and hope in everybody's hearts. And very shortly after that, the Mahasamadhi happened, and it was such a blow at all levels for everybody, including myself. And in an instance, we felt our world was just crumbling down, and it was like somebody had pulled the rug from under our feet and ripped off the background against which we had lived all our lives, all our dreams, all our fantasies. Just didn't know what to say, do. At that time, I felt this huge surge of responsibility from within me, and I felt I'm Swami's daughter. And I have to lend a hand to those. I knew how shell-shocked the devotees were. But I felt I had a responsibility as Swami's daughter and his student. And I found myself having to speak at more centers, at more meetings, constantly. The very moment the news came, it was nightfall, and we immediately rushed to the Toronto York Center. And for next 3 days, the centers were open 24/7. People were walking in, wailing, crying, collapsing in the lobby. And I found that in person, I was so devastated. I was a basket case. But every time I stood at the podium in front of the microphone, someone else spoke through me. I never knew what I was going to say. Swami was doing all the talking. I never knew what sentence or would emerge from my mouth next, or how this thought process would unfold. How would I take this talk to its logical conclusion? I found I was in a state of chauffeur-driven consciousness. Somebody else was operating from within me. So one part of me was devastated in private, but the public part of me was so courageous and so calm and relatively so much more composed that, you know, just being there for people, holding their hand, taking them inside, just patting their backs, giving them tissues, walking them, talking to them, consoling them, that yes, all of a sudden everything has changed in our life in an instant. Because if we truly believe who Swami is, then nothing has changed. Everything is just the same.
Would you say that Swami had planned this duty for you, taking you away to Toronto?
That's what a lot of people felt. And
just to have this cathartic experience, you know, to let it all out and to, you know,
perhaps,
in sharing with others, you cured yourself in a way.
Oh yes, always, you know, when you share your love with others, you always heal yourself. And I also found that when I spoke at these many centers in the US and in Canada, stuff that I had not prepared, and I didn't know whatever I was ever going to get up and speak.
And everybody was looking at you with hope.
Hope, yes. Yeah. And, you know, they were looking for some kind of a reassurance or consolation. It's very hard to make sense and be rational and calm and composed when you're hurting and so sad yourself. So it was Swami who did it all. And people would come up to me and say, you know, when you spoke, we felt Swami was speaking to us. And I said, so did I, because I wasn't speaking. It was Swami speaking truly. And I thought that just being blank in the mind and being in a state of utter surrender is all I did. The rest Swami did. So I was just an instrument, and it was such an honor that Swami chose me for it.
This is a thought that has, I live in Dubai and I'm long distance. I'm not fortunate like you to be in the physical realm. The thought that has often occurred to me is, after the Mahasamadhi, has there something altered within Puttaparthi itself? Is there a dip in energy?
You know, when I returned to Puttaparthi within weeks of the Mahasamadhi, every time I entered the Ganesha gate, I felt this sad energy hit me, and all I wanted to do was cry forever. But with each passing day, and I actually found it very hard to go into the Sai Kulwant Hall. I was very happy coming to work, but going to the Kulwant Hall was a very difficult and painful experience. And shortly after that, they boarded up the area where the Mahasamadhi is, because the Mahasamadhi work was being done. But with each passing day, the love with which the students sang the Vedam and the Bhajan, it just cleared the air. It's my theory that, you know, the sadness of the lakhs of devotees who had come for the Mahasamadhi, it was still lingering here. But with the Vedam chanting and the Bhajan singing, Swami just lifted the sadness away. And by the time of the Guru Purnima, when the Mahasamadhi was unveiled, there was this enormous resurgence of energy, positive energy and happiness. And much as we thought we would be devastated to see the Mahasamadhi, we felt uplifted when the curtains parted and the aarti was offered to the divine Mahasamadhi. And today this Mahasamadhi is a living, breathing, vibrating, responding shrine. When we inch towards it, as you did this morning, Vasanti,
yes,
and I don't know if you share my perspective.
I do.
You feel you're having a personal audience with Bhagwan himself.
Absolutely. It's a one-to-one conversation.
It is. Absolutely. So this is a, Swami is there, and the Mahasamadhi is the holiest of shrines on the face of earth as far as I'm concerned. And I can share that yesterday, for instance, I was feeling very overwhelmed about a few things in my life. So I quickly came to office and wrote a letter to Bhagwan. And I ran for bhajan. And after aarti, as I was inching to the Mahasamadhi, I said, Swami, have you read my letter? Usually as I write stuff, I hand it all over to him in my heart. It's all his now. My worries are his. Just then a butterfly flew in from the Mahasamadhi towards me, and I said, Swami, if that's you, please come and settle on me. And it did, and it sat there, and I closed my eyes and I kept reading the contents of my letter, all the 5-6 issues I had written out to Swami, and the butterfly stayed on me. And after that, once I had placed my forehead on the cool marble slab there, my worries were gone. I was walking on air. I dropped my letter in the basket there for letters to Bhagwan. And from that moment onwards, I knew Swami had taken over.
You asked me if I felt like that this morning. In fact, this is my first visit after the Mahasamadhi, and I was quite nervous at having to confront a place without the physical form. And my heart was actually beating very fast. When I entered the Kulwant Hall, I mean, I felt, like you said, a surge of joy. I mean, he is not there, but there is something else.
He is there in the cosmic form.
In the cosmic form, and you feel that. You feel that presence.
Totally.
Karuna, you're a prolific writer. You have been a proficient journalist. As a person associated with the media, what do you think should be done to spread the Sai message without riding on the propaganda tool?
Very good question. I'd love to quote a well-known Canadian communications specialist. His name is Marshall McLuhan, and he said, he coined this phrase, the medium is the message. It's open to many interpretations, and I understand Marshall's little quote that the medium is the message to mean that each of us is a medium of Swami's message if we live it. So the best way to spread Swami's message is to live it, so that we can influence the immediate circle of within our families, workplaces and communities. Having said that, creating positive awareness about Swami's message and his impact is the duty of each and every devotee of Swami. Now at Radio Sai, as you have noticed, you may have noticed, we take this duty very seriously. And we also have to walk a very fine line, because Bhagwan is totally opposed to any kind of propaganda or publicity. For 60 odd years, Swami's mission went on helping and serving humanity without a murmur, without a news headline, because Radio Sai did not exist till then. By the time Radio Sai came into existence, one thing that Professor Venkatraman, who is the head of Radio Sai, had clarified with Bhagwan was that, Bhagwan, we totally respect what you tell us about not looking for cheap publicity, newspaper headlines, but we would like to create positive awareness about the facts. And Swami was okay with creating positive awareness in a suitable environment. So I'm very happy to inform you that everything we do here at Radio Sai to create this awareness is based on objective reporting, statistical evidence and in-depth research, as opposed to any attempt to push an ideology or sensationalism or any kind of agenda. So we are very responsible, we practice responsible journalism, and we have, the medium has to become a message. So Radio Sai, we conduct ourselves in a manner that reflects his message, or we strive to do so. And we realize that we have to be very careful when it comes to accountability, authenticity, honesty, because 5 years from now, 50 years from now, or 500 years from now, or 5,000 years from now, these stories have to stand the test of time. So we are never hungry to grab newspaper headlines or seek publicity. And you know, the Sai culture is always called for a restraint. And we have to honor that and respect and work within those parameters. So I'm all for creating positive awareness. I'm all for creating that awareness most potently through personal example, role modeling. But I'm against any kind of propaganda.
The Sai movement itself. What is the new reality after the Mahasamadhi?
I can only speak from my point of view, which according to me is that those who were able to connect with Swami as the omnipresent, omnipotent and omniscient Lord from within, their connection has only strengthened after the Mahasamadhi. Those who were truly devoted to Him and related to Him as the God, the divine being that He was, their devotion has only grown manifold. I notice a burning passion today amongst His devotees, especially so in the students, to stand up tall for Swami and do what it takes to bring glory to the divine name, to act and to think and to speak in a manner that befits our divine Lord. I wish we were where we are today, 30 years ago as a movement. We would have just taken over the world. Because I feel the drive and the passion and the devotion to Swami now is stronger. And this Mahasamadhi has really separated the chaff from the grain. Those who are for Swami are there for Swami with not part-time, not half-heartedly, but wholeheartedly. So it's been in that sense, it's been amazing. I really can't comment on those who connected with Swami only at a physical level, because those who have internalized, for them, this is our die or do moment. And it's now or never. And that's why you can see the movement is surging forward, is growing leaps and bounds. In the short time after the Mahasamadhi, so much has happened. So many good and positive things have happened. That's because people are realizing that responsibility, that sense of urgency. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I know that Swami's cosmic form has to touch every life form on the planet. And for nearly 45 years, Swami and I bonded as best of buddies. So now it's really my turn to wake up and realize that love is a two-way street. It's reciprocal. And I need to do what it takes to share and circulate the abundance that He has blessed me with in my life.
I just have about two more questions. We're drawing to the end of the conversation.
And I'm feeling a little relieved to know that.
No, I'm doing this two questions because we're running short of time.
Okay.
We have lots more to ask, but again, we'll have to keep that for a later time. For now, I have this question that you have been serving the Sai mission very actively for the past 20 years. And for the best working years of your life, you worked full-time for the Sai mission first at the Satya Sai School of Canada in Toronto and now for Radio Sai. What triggered such a commitment that you gave up all your professional ambition to serve the Sai mission with such zeal? You even relocated to Parthi from your well-established life of 20 long years in Canada. What was the driving, of course Swami is the driving factor, but to give it all up and to just move back to Parthi? Enormous willpower, enormous decision-making.
It had really very little to do with me. As I told you, every time I deviate from the path of the five human values, I get a knock on my head and sometimes I get a huge bang. And this began when I got this enormous bang on my head because I had a very deeply personal and moving experience. In sometime, I think it was in the year 2003, I used to live in Toronto and my sister-in-law was migrating from India to the US in the Boston area. So we decided, my husband and I and our son, who was I think 2 years old at that time, so it might have been 2002, on a very cold, wintry, snowstormy day, we had to drive in a large van from Toronto to Boston. a day prior to my sister-in-law's arrival, and we were planning to set up a stay with our sister from the Anandpur College, an ex-student named Mrs. Mallika Deshal. We were staying in her house at Amherst, Massachusetts for the night, and next day my sister-in-law would arrive. And we set off on our journey under very cloudy, dismal skies. But as we hit the highway, we realized that this was going to be very difficult because the northeastern part of U.S. had an enormous snowstorm. And along this journey, in the first 6-7 hours, we found about 40 cars belly up, abandoned along the side of the road, on which you could not see the surface of the road. Only a few places you could see the tire marks. So we were driving extremely slowly because the road was very uneven with so much of snow on it. And we were just trying to make sure we drove over the previous tire marks so we wouldn't fall into a ditch. And it was very, very stressful. And I remember constantly chanting the Gayatri Mantra, and my husband was driving, and I kept hoping that the baby would keep sleeping in the car seat, so that, you know, I just kept putting his bottle in his mouth. And it was a miserable day. We were very nervous. I was drinking antacid throughout because of the heartburn from the stress of driving through that storm. And about 6-7 hours later than we were expected, we managed to reach the house of our hosts late at night. And they were very relieved. And we lost our cell phone network in the storm, so we couldn't contact anybody. So, you know, we were almost missing. The next morning, my husband decided he would go to the Boston airport to pick early because he wanted to give himself enough time to drive. And he'd be there by the time my sister-in-law would arrive in the afternoon or so. So I was with the baby and just sort of recovering from the previous day's stress and getting ready to receive our sister-in-law. And about a couple of hours after my husband left, or maybe a bit longer, my sister-in-law called from the airport. She said, "Well, how come you guys didn't come to pick me up?" I said, "What are you talking about? So, my husband had left many hours earlier, and he actually decided to leave a few hours extra early so that he could, you know, just explore the area around Boston Airport. And everyone said there was a lot of construction on the highway, so you have to take a lot of detours. So he gave himself plenty of time to get there in time. So long story short, she was stranded on that airport. First time out of India, second time in her life on a flight. She landed at the Boston airport without anyone to receive because we could not trace my husband. And I tried calling him on his cell phone, and 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 hours went by, and by now my panic bells were going. And I was calling everywhere to see if I could trace him. I even called home in Toronto because his car had an Ontario license plate, and I thought if he was in an accident, then perhaps they would have informed the home address. So when I called home, where my 10-year-old little daughter was with my sister and my mother-in-law, they were all panic-stricken. They said, "No, we haven't heard from him." And it was a very awkward situation. I was staying with a friend. There was 20 feet with the child, 2-year-old child. There was 20 feet of snow outside. And I had a missing husband, and I had a helpless sister-in-law waiting at an airport, and it was getting dark. He had left in the morning at 10. So I was so panic-stricken. We tried to see if the control room had any news, the police control room. He was untraceable. At that time, I went into the basement of my friend's house where there was an altar, and I sat there and I prayed to Swami, and I suddenly started to realize what was happening to my life. And in a country where you can even find a missing vehicle with the GPS chip in it, a grown-up adult with a wallet full of credit cards and ID cards and a big, huge 7-seater van had gone missing. This was something was missing, wrong with the situation. And I the truth started to dawn on me. And I was petrified. And I felt a fear I had never, ever experienced in my life before. It was right there in my tummy, in my gut. And I sat there and I said to Swami, "Swami, I'm not ready for this. I'm not strong enough, and I cannot handle the eventuality that is facing me right now. And I know you can do anything. This is what I want you to do, Swami. I want you to take time back. You are the master of time. Reverse the time and restore normalcy in my life now. And I want it now." You know, talk of being patient with God. So when I said that to Swami, I said, "Swami, do it now. Just somehow make it 10 o'clock when everything was normal in my life. She was still in the air. He was still driving at home. Everything was okay." And at that time, in that moment of fear, I experienced incredible clarity. It was like my entire life was playing out before me. I saw it scene by scene, and I saw all the errors I had made in my life, including the one of constantly asking Swami to keep me in a state of bliss. I always asked Swami for bliss, and every time Swami gave me an opportunity to serve Him, I would do it. But like on the fringe, on the periphery, it's like, you know, standing on the side of a pool and you dip your feet to experience how the water is, as opposed to just diving, plunging into the pool and having a nice swim. So I was that person on the periphery, and I had had many opportunities to dive in, but I had resisted. And I realized, here I was making such a huge demand on God. Take time back. Restore normalcy in my life. Make it all okay. I am not ready for this. I can't handle this eventuality. And I had done nothing to listen to what He wanted me to do. So I had to make a pact with Swami at that moment. I said, Swami, I know I have missed my bus many times. So at this moment, if You can just rescue me out of this horrible situation that I am in, I promise You that whatever You have taught me, if You've taught me to dot an I and cross a T, if You taught me to speak, breathe, swim, walk, talk, drive, I will use every talent or every skill You gave me only to serve You and to glorify You, and nothing else. The moment I lead this prayer at the altar, the Amrit emerged from Swami's picture and the phone rang, and we found my husband. He was fine. He was all good. He had just forgotten his phone in the car, and there was like a huge comedy of errors that had resulted in this horrible situation that had almost killed me out of fear. So I knew Swami had responded, and lo and behold, 2 hours later, my sister-in-law and my husband were home safe, and then all remained to be done was to go back to Toronto and do what I had promised Swami. So the first thing, the first order of business, I made a phone call to the Satyasai school, because the school was already operating and I was one of the volunteers in one of the committees. And throughout the existence of the school, I heard Swami's voice loud and clear, like a bell, telling me to get involved and do more. But I continued to stay a volunteer in the spiritual awareness committee and not do more. So I made a call to the then principal. I told him the facts as they were, and I joined in.
And then coming to Parthi?
It was an inner calling, and it was entirely Swami's doing. And a lot of people have asked me, how could you make such a big move? Even I don't know. And if I try to rationalize, it makes no sense. But I think when you're driven by a higher power and you're guided from within, things just fall into place. And it was a decision, very surprisingly, very few people believe, I did not make. It was my husband who was visiting here actually from Dubai on a holiday, and he just decided that he felt very happy being in Parthi, and this is where he wanted to be. So he bought a home for us, and after that we moved. And so when we had to wind up 20 years worth of life in Toronto, the first order of business was to sell a huge house. And the recession had just set in. The global economic meltdown had happened a few months prior. So it was very hard to sell big homes. And I didn't want to go. I was so busy winding up my work at the school. I didn't want to have to, you know, set up the home and keep it ready for viewing or seeing by the real estate agent and potential buyers. So I put in a prayer at Swami's lotus feet, and I read the Satcharita, and I said, can You help me with this, Swami? And one day before the house would be listed, it was sold privately to a friend, and there was no hitch whatsoever. The only part we did, my husband and I, was to practice sealing on desires and list it at a relatively reasonable and low price. We were not getting greedy with it because we were not looking for multiple offers. We just wanted to close the deal, and it happened in no time. Everything fell into place. We saw Swami's hand in all that we did.
Okay, thanks so much. And one last question, which has nothing to do with your stay here or with the experience that you bring with you here. You are a very self-aware woman, well-educated, devoted to Sai values. What are your thoughts on feminism? And what do you make of the women's liberation movement?
You said it had nothing to do with anything I do here. I think it has everything to do with what I do here.
Okay.
I work in a totally male-driven workplace, male-populated workplace.
Mm-hmm.
So it has a lot to do with my sense of being. And I draw my definition of feminism from what Bhagwan says. I do not subscribe to the view, which I find very amusing, that a woman needs a man as much as a fish needs a bicycle. That's not my view of feminism at all. I understand that what Swami says, that in the entire creation, humanity is the crown of creation. And in humankind, it's the woman who is the crest jewel of God's creation. Because women alone have those divine qualities that reflect Swami's divine nature, sacrifice, compassion, love, unconditional love, forgiveness, acceptance. Only a mother, only a woman, and every woman is a mother, whether she's biological or not, is not of consequence. That nurturing nature is natural to us. So I believe when I understand women's liberation movement, I don't judge it from the point of view of financial liberation, monetary liberation, professional liberation. I vote for atmic liberation. Because if you believe who you truly are, you are a spark of divinity. And if you believe that the nature of divine is such that fire cannot burn it, water cannot wet it, wind cannot blow it, death cannot annihilate it, then what is it that can hold you back? What is it that you're afraid of? Who is it that you are not? So if you actually subscribe to that view, then you truly are God. And that is the view of feminism, because as Swami said, women have such qualities of patience and forbearance and sacrifice. And I think those are not our weaknesses, as sometimes the Western feminist movement might suggest. I think those are our strengths. And once we believe in our true reality, we truly are feminists. And I think that's what helps me to survive in a place where I'm the only woman working with a bunch of very, very considerate and sensitive male colleagues who are very, very nice to work with, very committed to Swami and same mindset. But it's become easy being who I am and thinking along these lines to work just about anywhere.
So shall I say, let our tribe increase?
Amen to that.
Okay. Thank you so much, Karuna, for that very engrossing conversation. I mean, so much so that I think I got lost in it to a large extent. And I'm sure all our listeners would have gained as much value as I did. Thank you very much for this very, very informative talk.
And I'd like to thank you and Bhagwan for the opportunity. As always, I rely entirely on him for my strength and offer this talk also at his lotus feet. Sai's Glory.
Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome back to Morning Glory on May the 9th, 2013. We hope you found some worth in my conversation with my colleague, Ms. Vasanti Sundaram, Radio Sai's contributing editor based in Dubai. And yes, your feedback matters very much. We look forward to your emails at listener@radiosai.org. The time right now in Prashanthi Nilayam is 10:22 a.m. It also happens to be the very perfect moment to celebrate the all-inclusive, multi-faith vision of the Sai movement. As I told you last week, Prashanthi Nilayam was host to a symposium on unity of faiths on 2nd of July 2012 with addresses in the morning on Hinduism by His Holiness Swami Dayanand Saraswati and on Islam by Professor Akhtarul Wasi. Last week on Morning Glory, you enjoyed listening to Professor Akhtarul Wasi. Today I have a treat lined up from His Holiness Swami Dayanand Saraswati, an internationally respected Vedantist. You will first hear the symposium moderator, Dr. Sri Rangarajan of the Sri Satya Sai University, introduce the speaker, and then it is over to His Holiness Swami Dayanand Saraswati's talk that was delivered in the Sai Kulwant Hall at Prashanthi Nilayam on 2nd of July last year, that is 2012. But before I play it, may I request you to please keep your feedback coming. And till we meet next Thursday, please be well, keep seeking, and do whatever it takes to stay positive. Over now to His Holiness Swami Dayanand Saraswati's talk, which will be followed by the next segment, Service, Love in Action. Sai Ram.
Be it Shaivites or Vaishnavites among the Hindus, Shias or the Sunnis in Islam, or Catholics or Protestants in Christianity, no sect extols violence and falsehood. In fact, all of them have endeared to humankind to engage in spiritual sadhana, to make communion with the divine self. Zoroastrianism preaches the threefold message of humta, hukta and huvrashta, which means good thoughts, good words and good deeds. Buddha taught that nirvana can be attained only by cultivating samyak drishti, samyak vak, samyak shravanam, samyak bhavam and samyak kriya. Bhagwan says, see no evil, see what is good, hear no evil, hear what is good, talk no evil, talk what is good. Think no evil, think what is good. And do no evil, do what is good. This is the way to God. I'm tempted to share a very small incident before I invite the second speaker. Couple of years ago, Bhagwan had called few faculty members into the bhajan hall for a private audience. And there he started narrating the story of Mahabharata. And this was the episode where Lord Krishna seemingly failed in all the attempts to bring about peace. And as he was returning from the palace of Duryodhana, he created an opportunity to meet Karna in privacy. And there Lord Krishna takes Karna to him and tells him the long hidden truth that he was actually the son of Mother Kunti and the sixth Pandava. And then he tells Karna, now please think about the implications of the war in this changed scenario. And he appealed to him to make peace. We know what happened then, how Karna was overpowered by his sense of gratitude to Duryodhana than showing his duty towards Dharma or his brothers. But the point is, Swami stopped the story here. He looked at us very sternly, as he normally does when he wants to give an important message, and he said, even all of you are brothers. If you cause pain, if you cause suffering, if you cause injury to others, remember, it will come back to your own self. The earlier you realize this, the better. Otherwise, all of you will regret like Karna when this truth of oneness inevitably dawns on you. Through the simple story of Karna, Bhagwan had communicated the essence of religion to all of us. Recognizing the oneness and living in this oneness is the true purpose of religion. We now have the honor of listening to His Holiness Sri Swami Dayananda Saraswati Ji. Sri Swami Dayananda Saraswati is a distinguished traditional teacher of Vedanta. His depth of understanding and nuanced appreciation of Western culture makes him that rare teacher who can communicate the vision of non-duality to modern listeners. Swami Dayananda has been teaching Vedanta both to the public and to resident students in short and long-term courses in India for more than four decades and around the world since 1976. Swami Dayananda designed and taught 10 resident in-depth Vedanta courses, each spanning 30 to 36 months. Each course graduated about 60 qualified acharyas or teachers who are now teaching around the world, and they are highly respected as venerable Swamijis. A number of Veda Pathshalas have also been established by Swami Dayananda to revive and preserve the Veda Shakhas that are getting extinct. To make the teaching more widely available, he has created a Bhagavad Gita home study program and the Purna Vidya teaching program. Under his guidance, numerous centers of Vedic teaching have been founded around the world. The two main centers in India are in Rishikesh and Coimbatore, and in USA, the center is at Pennsylvania. At present, there are more than 100 centers in India and abroad that carry on the tradition of Vedantic teaching. He has also promoted several international events and participated as a speaker in several global forums like the UNESCO Seoul Global Convention, the United Nations 50th Anniversary Celebration, the Millennium World Peace Summit, the International Congress for Preservation of Religious Diversity, and many others. In addition to teaching, Swami Dayananda has initiated and supported various philanthropic efforts under the auspices of the Acharya Sabha convened by Swami Dayananda in 2002. He initiated an All India movement called Aim for Seva, awarded the consultative status with ECOSOC, Economic and Social Council, by the United Nations in 2005. This organization is devoted to serving people in the remote areas of India through its main project of homes for children going to school. Nearly 90 such homes from Kanyakumari to Karnaprayag serve as a nucleus to bring education, healthcare and infrastructure to people to whom these were inaccessible earlier. We now welcome His Highness Swami Dayananda Saraswati Ji to come and address us. Swami Dayananda Saraswati.
Ishwaro Guru Ratneti Murti Bheda Vibhagini Vyomavat Vyapta Dehaya Dakshina Murti Namaha. Om. I am very happy to be here. A place of a person who had inspired millions of people. Not only of this country, people from all cultures, all countries. That he was able to do this because he was a symbol a manifestation of the Vedic culture, religion, wisdom. What goes under the name Hinduism is one Sanatana Dharma, never founded by anybody, a Dharma which had produced in every generation great people. That it is able to produce great people because of its vision, of its view of life and reality, and the way of life advocated to achieve that reality. Someone said, when he was asked, what is Hinduism? The great philosopher. He said, it's a view and way of life. Totally true. The highest view that you can have is its view. Unique view. God is great is a belief. You can be great is a hope. All that is great is just you, is the view. There is no one greater than you, much less lesser than you. You are Purnaha, you are the whole. Just think of it. If there is such a thing as the whole, it can never be separate from you. If it is separate from you, it is not whole. It misses you. It is as simple as this. How people can miss, it's a wonder. You are the whole. And therefore, if you deny yourself this particular fact, not knowing, of course, then you will be struggling to become the whole, because it is against, your conclusion is against your own nature. As a human being, you are conscious of yourself. Not only just conscious of yourself as a person, you are judgmental. You can make a judgment because you are free. Your consciousness is uninhibited. And naturally, therefore, you have a judgment about yourself. In that judgment, there is a deficiency. And therefore, there is unacceptability. And therefore, seeking. Acceptability is the end of everybody's life, every human being. If there is a celestial being who is conscious of himself or herself as a person, that person will have the same problem. Self-acceptance is the issue. The self is acceptable is the view, the Hindu view, the Vedic view of reality. The self is totally acceptable. The acceptability is 100%. Whoever you are. And when you are totally acceptable, self-loath, self-pity, self-disapproval, struggling to approve myself stems from self-ignorance. This is amazing. We have the last word about you. Nobody is going to improve this. You are the whole. And you do experience this wholeness occasionally. Whenever you are happy, the wholeness is the experience. No one can deny the reality of being happy, reality of oneself, which is the wholeness, and that is experienced in every moment of happiness. It may be in the wake of an object you like to have, an experience, something that captures your imagination. You can never say that now I never had a moment of happiness. You always had a moment of happiness. In fact, that keeps us going. These moments are very few and far between, but they do happen. If I am such a wanting, self-loathing, loathable person, how come that I could be happy for a moment? How I can deny myself? I can I go against myself? My thinking is that I am deficient. My experience occasional is I'm happy. Happy means I accept myself, I accept the world, I accept my in-laws too. You cannot be happy. Complaining, you cannot be happy. You accept yourself, your body, your teeth alignment, your color, your height, your weight, of course. You need to accept all of them. You have to accept the stars, your Shukra, your Shani, all of them. to have a moment of happiness is to accept all that is here totally, including yourself as a person, your color, height, etc., your knowledge, your memory, your ignorance, your limitations, all you are not at all mindful of all limitations. A moment of happiness reveals the truth. The truth that is, you are the whole. We are searching for the wholeness. The Vedic view is, you are missing the wholeness. Iha chet avedit ata satyam asti na chet iha avedit mahati vinashti. If you miss to recognize the fact about yourself that you are the whole, and the whole lifetime you will be searching for the wholeness. One lifetime is not enough. Until one discovers this, one never rest content. You are the problem because you are self-conscious and self-judging. You are the solution because you can discover yourself. This is the view of life. The way of life that will fashion my whole living fashion me and my way of living to unfold this wholeness, discover this wholeness, and therefore we have a very well laid out way of life. Two fellows are walking. One of them is a sculptor. The sculptor stops at a point, admires a wayside stone, a wayside rock, no shape, nothing, just a rock, a monolithic rock. He admires, he stops, doesn't move. His friend asks him, what is it you are looking here? Is it this rock? What is there in this rock? It's a wayside rock. What is it that you see here? He said, I will tell you later. Let us take this rock to the studio where he is working as a sculptor. With some help, the rock was taken and his friend has left. Meets him after a month or two, again in the same studio. There stands an idol of Krishna. This fellow is a Krishna Bhakta, the friend. There stands a Krishna with Tribhangas. Now this fellow is admiring. He stands there, he can't take his eyes away. How beautiful it is, how real it is. Look at the smile. This fellow is all admiration. And then looks for his friend, the sculptor, who is standing there in one corner with a fine chisel and hammer. Asks him, "Did you make this?" He said, "Yes." "When?" "This is the one you helped me bring the other day." "You asked me on that day, what is it you are looking at this rock?" "This is what I was looking at, the rock. In fact, I didn't look at the rock. I looked at Krishna. I saw this rock ideal for this Krishna. You think that I created this Krishna? Not at all. I unfolded Krishna. I removed all those portions of stone that covered Krishna. It is not, I did not shape Krishna. I made all the naked eyes to see Krishna. The Krishna that I saw with my eye of a sculptor." Understand? This is Vedic view. You are the whole. Your life should be such, it should help that wholeness manifest in every action, in every situation. You have got to bring that wholeness up. Sometimes our smallness gets the better of our bigness. The smallness comes out in lying, in cheating, in taking advantage of somebody's weak situation. It is my insecure being who comes out. My smallness comes out. My bigness is just lying buried for want of satsanga, for want of proper vichara, for want of certain degree of adequacy. This smallness can come out, can take you over And therefore, a Hindu has a word like this. I don't think in any culture there is a word like this. Yuktaha, Atmavan, Jitendriyaha, Jitakrodaha, Atmavan. This is a very significant word, Atmavan. You know Balavan, you know Gunavan, but you means something you have, which you generally don't have. Dhanavan, you have got Dhanam, therefore Dhanavan. You have got some good qualities, therefore Gunavan. Everybody has Atma, you cannot say Atmavan. But in Sanskrit, in Hindu culture, there is such a word called Atmavan. Do you know why? Because you lose yourself. To be Atmavan is to be together. My smallness has to be kept under check. And therefore, we have a word, Yuktaha, Atmavan, Jitendriyaha. You don't get carried away by your own fancies and pressures and needs, and you hold them all together. To be Atmavan, not easy, but that's a value. Our way of life should be such. It helps me discover myself. A person who is not dictated by my own fancies, my own likes and dislikes, but I make my choices and I do what is to be done and avoid what is to be avoided. This is not easy, but we have a way of life that will unfold my bigness. Like that Krishna. Already there Krishna. Purnaha is there. Krishna means Ananda. Purna is there already. You need a Rama. The Dharmavan. The one who follows Dharma. Ramaha. Vigrahavan Dharmaha. He, the Dharma, has two hands and two legs. And that is Rama. When Dharma is there, Krishna Ananda follows. The way of life is Dharma. And Dharma is very important for us. Dharma is not a mandate of God. This mandate of God means it always created problems. It's not a mandate of God. Dharma is a manifestation of God. See the difference. It is a manifestation of God. Every religion has to recognize it. Dharma is itself God. And for God's sake, I cannot go against Dharma. It would be a defect in creation. If a human being given so much freedom, free will, and he is not given a mechanism to control himself, it would be a lacuna in creation. It's something like a fellow is given a Ferrari and there is no brake system in Ferrari. So if there is no brake system in Ferrari to this young man, and you know, who is this young man and is restless, and this fellow is given a Ferrari without a brake system, danger to himself, danger to everybody else. Human being is given this freedom. Every animal is programmed. Therefore, your cow will be a vegetarian even in America. The mother cow and other cows need not tell the cow, please be careful, you are going to America. Meat and food don't destroy our culture. We are born vegetarians. For generations we are vegetarian. From Kamadhenu downwards we are vegetarian. Don't bring any bad name to us. Need not the mother cow or any other cow, need not tell this young cow going abroad. It will remain vegetarian. If the hamburger is thrown to a cow, it will taste the buns and leave everything to the human being. What is in between is a fellow cow. It is programmed, it lives by its own programming. Every animal does it. A human being is endowed with the free will. He has to make a choice, he or she. What is to be eaten? How it is to be eaten? How also? When one should eat, how much one should eat, whether one should eat, where he eats, is also important. You have to make your choice. You have no choice in exercising choice. You have to exercise your choice. When that is so, I must be endowed with the mechanism, with some understanding, which makes me responsible for what I do, makes you responsible for what you do. What you do does not hurt me. What I do doesn't hurt you. This is a common basis, a matrix of values, which are very common to all and sundry. And these cannot be made universally understood by any means of communication. It's impossible. But it is universal. Why universal? Because it is given. It is given to me that I should not get hurt. I know it very well. A cow also knows it should not get hurt. If the cow hurts you, being threatened, it hurts you. It's not going to have any guilt. Much less you can bring it to the court. Whereas you have not only the knowledge that I should not get hurt without being told by anybody, by my common sense, I know that you also don't want to get hurt. This is not given by anybody. You don't need anybody in history to come and tell me this. If I'm a human being with a head on my shoulders, I know this. I don't want to get hurt. Others also don't want to get hurt. I know this. This is called Samanya Dharma. Samanya means universal. This is not only for one set of people, no. For all. All means all. Every human being has this knowledge given by common sense. Faculty is given and the common sense is given and knowledge born of common sense is given that I don't want to get hurt and I know others also don't want to get hurt. Dharma. This is Bhagavan. I would like to tell you this what is here is Bhagavan. We don't say Bhagavan is up or Bhagavan is down. All that is here is Bhagavan. Bhagavan cannot have an address. Where is your son? California. Where is your daughter? In London. Nobody is locally available. Where is your daughter? She is in London. Where is your uncle? He is in Texas. Where is God? He is in heaven. Okay? Everybody has an address. And an email also. Everybody has an address. This, we don't give address to Bhagavan. Isha Vasyam Idam Sarvam. All that is here is Ishvara. We don't say there are many gods. We don't worship idols either. You don't say idol e namaha. We don't worship gods. Not many gods. We don't say there is one God. This one God has brought problem to us. One God people bring problems to humanity. We say, God is not one. God is not many. There is no one God. There are not many gods. There is only God. Enough? There is only God. There is only God. If there is only God, every manifestation is Ishvara. He is Bhagavan. The manifestation of Dharma right in my head is Bhagavan. Therefore, for God's sake, I cannot go against God. Understand? For God's sake, I cannot go against God. End does not justify the means. For us, the means is God. End will take care of itself. The means is what is important. And therefore my way of life itself is a means to Ishvara. Discover that Purna. And therefore, once that Purna is discovered, I can say Antah Purnaha, Bahi Purnaha, Purna Kumbha Ivam, Purna Kumbha, Purna Kumbha Ivambare. Suppose you take a pot and hold it in your hand. Antaha Purnaha. Space that is inside is Purna. Outside it is Purna. Purna Kumbha Yuvambare. Similarly, if you take this pot into the ocean and dip it, Antah Purnaha, Bahih Purnaha, inside it is Purna, outside it is Purna. It is just one Purna. And therefore, this is a complete dharma. The view is you are Purnaha. Nobody can improve it. I am saying the last word. You are Purnaha. Who will improve? And your way of life should be such, it brings out the Purna. This is Hinduism. Because for us, God is to be discovered. God is not a matter of belief. God is to be understood. Idam Sarvam Ishvara means, you see Idam Sarvam. That is, Ishvara is a thing to be discovered. It's a thing to be discovered. The only dharma in which Ishvara is to be discovered, not a matter of belief. What is Ishvara? It is to be discovered. And therefore, we can validate all forms of prayer as our Baba was validating all forms of prayer, all forms of worship. In all languages, God is not someone subject to linguistic problems. So whether you pray to him in Hindi or in English or Latin or Urdu, God understands. If you of course pray in Sanskrit, he would understand because that is his own language, you know. So this is how we look at it. It is Deva Bhasha. In any language, in any form of prayer, and at any altar, everything is Ishvara. In any one form you can invoke him. There is no question of a prayer. It's a prayer and it is not valid. You cannot say that. Any form of prayer, any place. This is all we are able to say because of the vision and the way of life. View and way of life. Thank you all for this morning. So, I'll take you.